يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series taking a close look at the Middle East, North Africa region. Well, hello, and I would say welcome to Middle East Analysis, but seeing as that particular programme went on something of a hiatus, I'll explain that this is more of a special on Iran, because when you bring a podcast series to an end and then something cataclysmic, global, takes the attention of the world, then obviously you've got to do something about it. And so, as a group, we decided it would be highly appropriate to talk about not just the state of the world, but the war in Iran and its impact on the wider Middle East, North Africa region, and indeed the world. So for that, I'm joined by Dr. Harry Hagopian, international lawyer, consultant, and as you know, many other hats, and Bishop Jim Curry, who has been with us on the last two Middle East Analysis podcasts before we went into our break. Because, as I say, we thought it was important to bring this together, to have this conversation, and to see where we're at. So, first of all, good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, James.
Harry, I will, of course, start with you, with your expertise. It's really difficult to know where to start, whether it's, you know, the genesis of this war to sort of rid Iran of its nuclear capabilities, so-called, that I thought happened last June with the 12-day war. I'm just basically going to give you an open goal. Where do we start with this? Because I think there's a lot of confusion, a lot of confusing words coming out.
Well, first of all, thank you for hosting this special Iran Middle East analysis, James, and also thank you to Bishop Jim for joining us so early in the morning. I thought, and you both gentlemen agreed, that it would be important to reach out to the people who listen to Middle East analysis and find out a little bit more the context and the ramifications of what is turning into a cruel war, an unprepared war. Now, before we delve into the various issues that we're going to touch upon, hopefully quickly, let me say two things. The first one is that I'm terribly conscious that we are still in a war situation, and therefore we are not here to analyze what was and why did it happen. It's not a past tense, it's a present tense. And we cannot, for the life of me, no matter whether I'm a prophet or not, we cannot predict what turn this war could take in the next day, 2 days, or even longer. It might turn worse, or it might suddenly stop if President Trump decides he's had enough of it, or if the economic indicators show that. So what I would like to remind our listeners, when you listen to this podcast, which you will kindly prepare and produce, remember it's an incomplete episode, and you have to take it for what it is and not what it predicts to do. The second point I'd like to say is that I'm one of those people who know and is very fond of Jeremy Bone, the BBC international correspondent, or whatever his title is these days. Because this morning, this very morning, on the Today program on BBC Radio 4, at around 8:15 in the morning, and I'm giving you the time so people can do the iPlayer thing, he gave a summation of why we are here, went all the way back to the first Gulf War on Iraq with Bush Sr., and led his dissection of the situation, his analysis, lead him to where we are today on the war on Iran. So regardless of what Bishop Jim, you and I discuss in this 50 minutes or so, I would very much encourage our listeners to use that iPlayer facility for BBC and listen to Jeremy Bone, because this really drew the framework of how he saw that the mistakes of the wars, the two Gulf Wars, are unhappily being replicated in the war today.
And I have to say for our listeners, because in any situation where you're providing commentary or analysis on any situation, particularly a situation of war, it evolves very fast. So to give you a time marker, Harry's talking about the Today programme on Wednesday, the 11th of March. So
absolutely.
If you want to check that out, round about 8:15 and Jeremy Bowen's summation of the situation so far.
Absolutely. If you look at what has happened over the past 11, 12 days of the war, everybody at the start, at least in Europe, sort of said, this is illegal, this is unlawful, this is against international law. And I have absolutely no qualms with that, no dispute with that statement. As an international lawyer myself, I would say that I can't for the life of me understand how this war could be legal. But the interesting thing was a departure from previous times where people strained and bent backwards to try and explain that, no, actually it is legal under international law. What I found out this time is that this reckless war is being described by American politicians and by those supporting it as, who cares about international law these days? International law never achieved anything. We've had this conflict for so long, that conflict for so long. It's time to forget international law and to act more physically in the situation. And I thought to myself, wow, because if some of your listeners, James, have ever heard of a Prussian military theorist, Karl von Clausewitz, I studied him when I was doing international law, and I refreshed myself a few days ago on the back of this latest war because of an interview I was doing elsewhere. And in his famous collection of thoughts is called On War, but he basically has 9 principles of war. And I went through those 9 again. I refreshed my mind, my learning, my knowledge. And I couldn't find one of those 9 principles that actually said, you know what, yes, this is a legal war. So it's not a legal war. It's a war without goals, without an end goal, without an objective. And Clausewitz always used to say, when you start a war without having the final objective or end goal defined, then that war is going to stray into very dark imponderables. And this is what frightens me today, that if we do not manage to restrain ourselves, if the world community does not basically say, this cannot go on forever and a day, not only will it basically create another economic catastrophe that our Chancellor of the Exchequer would find difficulty in trying to explain to the ordinary people who receive their bills. In addition to that, the fact that the oil, the gas, the situation is so bad, in addition to that, one thing that is very important and which is never said in the media when I listen to the media, be that on radio or on television, everybody talks about, yes, no, this attack, that attack. What about the human cost of this war? And the human cost is not only to count how many people have died in Iran, how many people have died from the US soldiers, how many people have died across the whole region. The human value and the human cost is also of the incredible destruction that is being wrought upon Iran, which has a civilization going back 6 millennia. This is where I start.
No, absolutely. And Bishop Jim, let's give Harry's voice a little break there. Yeah, Harry mentioned that, you know, obviously the people, the human, the person in the middle of this. You're the Bishops' Conference lead bishop for the Holy Land, so you have, you know, plenty to say about the region. I know Iran's not necessarily an area of expertise, obviously. But your brother Bishop, Bishop Bosco MacDonald, he made several good points. He did pray that the hard work of dialogue would triumph over the terrible ease of escalation, which I thought was a really nice turn of phrase for that, and made this the obvious fair point that it's the vulnerable that carry the heaviest burden. So what should our Christian response be to this war?
Well, thank you for mentioning Bishop Bosco's statement. I think it was really welcome, and the prayer that accompanied it. I've been able to use that prayer wherever I've been. Taking up Harry's point there and the Christian response, I think if you listen to Pope Leo and his plea for the end of hostilities and his plea to pay attention to the suffering of the innocent people, I mean, in the fog of war, it's difficult to know what's true sometimes. And I heard a dispute yesterday on some commentators arguing about whether the recent bombing of a school in Iran was actually deliberate or an accident. And then there are questions whether AI is being involved. So we're struggling to understand this, what's going on. But the reality is the suffering of people who are in many ways innocent. And Iran is a country of 90 million people. And notwithstanding, you know, almost the universal concerns we all have about how Iran is run and its influence in the region, I think we constantly have to look to see how are the innocent being protected. I was very struck by the words of Cardinal Parolin, the Vatican Secretary of State, who criticized the US and Israeli strikes as undermining international law, saying that might has replaced justice. There is this sense that we are experiencing a disregard for the rule of law, and that, as some of the American bishops have pointed out, Cardinal Kupich has pointed out, that the war is being portrayed almost like a video game or a Wild West Western movie. The language that's being used by diplomats or by the White House, it's appalling, reducing the suffering of people to a game. I'm glad to see, you know, the German bishops, the Canadian bishops, the Irish bishops have all come out begging for a ceasefire, asking for international law to be protected, and for us to return to principles rather than brute force. And you say, yes, my expertise is not Iran, not by any stretch of the imagination, but the knock-on effect of the Iranian war in the Holy Land, just like in every other country, so access to food, access to aid. And I'd be very interested to hear Harry's opinion about what appears to be a deliberate attack by Israel on Lebanon, destabilizing further the region. So there is an extraordinary mix of concern here. And I know, talking with you earlier, James, many young people are perplexed by what's going on. This may be their first experience of war. Us sitting around here have seen wars and conflicts, and we know how to weather them to some degree in the comfort of our country. And we can't underestimate how well off we are. But for a new generation, they are seeing played out almost like a video game, a war, and they haven't got the language yet. So we need to help them understand this is not how the world should be. We've taken a different turn recently. Brute force seems to have the upper hand at the moment.
Thank you for the bishop for his wise and healing words, and that of his brother bishops across the world. Let me start off with a little story, and then I'll come to 2 points. I was a wee toddler when the Six-Day War of 1967 happened, when Israel occupied the West Bank, Gaza, the Golan Heights, and the Sinai Desert. And that was before I went to France, so I was really a kid. And I remember, during that war, being so afraid. It was my first experience of the war, of any war for that matter. And I was so afraid that I remember that I came out of I had one of those, do you call them beds or cots with side things to protect you from falling out? I left that, went and slept with mom and dad in their big bed as comfort. And I could hear, it didn't make sense then, but as I grew older and as I became a bit more aware of the realities around me and what mom and dad explained, or more to the point, my grandfather, who was really a source of wisdom for me, I could hear the Jordanian hawker hunters in the skies over the West Bank, over Ramallah and Jerusalem, and the Israeli-French Mirage supersonic planes. And the way I could distinguish this later is that the old British hawker hunters that were used by Jordan were really the sort of, they were all, the engine was pop, 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 whereas the Mirage used by Israel was the supersonic one. And I remember my mom telling me, you were crying because you were afraid as to what was going to happen to us. And then we woke up the next morning. We opened the door and we saw the rubble. We saw not too far from where we were living, and we were living in a pretty gated community. So that was my first impression. My second impression was in 1973 when there was another war. And yet again, I happened at that time to be holidaying in Jerusalem. And so from Jordan to Palestine to Israel to France, I could hear what was happening. And I remember the tension that was taking place. So when I now imagine myself in the place of those kids, I can well imagine the fear of those little kids. I was their age in 1967, how they would have reacted to the war. So people talk rather glibly about PTSD and how does trauma affect us. We don't really know how trauma affects us in this part of the world as well as they do there, where every few years there is another war, there is another bloodbath, there is another chapter of destruction. Now, on the back of that, I also want to talk about the Christians that Bishop Jim raised. And I would like to say that on the three occasions that I have visited Iran and spent time with a lot of people there, I was very, very fortunate to, as an Armenian, to touch base with the Armenian community. And the sense of hospitality in Iran is remarkable. It competes with, if it doesn't even override, Arab hospitality these days. And they took me around and they showed me everything from the churches, etc. And I am just dreading now, with all the destruction, with all the bombing that is happening, whether it's American signed or Israel signed, for all those churches, if anybody from our listeners has ever had the opportunity to go to Isfahan in the south of Iran, and to go to a neighborhood of Isfahan called New Julfa, the Armenian Orthodox churches there are out of this world. And you can see it on social media, because now social media, everybody is sort of putting pictures of this church, that church, this heritage, that heritage. And I'm just worried that in the heat of war rather than the fog of war, civilization is not only being tamed, it is being destroyed, because what gets destroyed doesn't come back again. And that is what worries me. The Armenian Christian community is the largest in Iran, but there are other communities as well. And when people talk about who are those Christians or when did these Christians come about, let us remember that those Christian communities have been there for centuries, and they have been part and parcel of the Iranian life there. And in my opinion, they have had a fairly okay life. Now, I realize that when it comes to missions, when it comes to new churches, the situation is not that easy, because one thing that Islam forbids is proselytism. And in that sense, all the churches that sort of have that evangelical streak to them, I unfortunately agree with them and feel for them, because they have a difficult time in the country. But for the main churches, they have had a fairly okay time given the realities of the region, which, unlike the West, is very, very religiously minded. And let me add here that only 2 days ago, the Belgian Catholic cardinal was taken out of Iran by the Italians because he lived in the Italian embassy and he is now in Rome.
No, I did indeed see that. Bishop Jim, you've got a document, the bishops have a document called Called to be Peacemakers. And in light of everything that Harry has said, although obviously we are as Christians called to be peacemakers, is that a bit fanciful? How would you look, when you're looking right in the eye of the storm, as it were, how can you advocate for peace? What is the appropriate way of drawing people to at least consider a peaceful solution?
I think was it Paul VI who said, you know, war, or John Paul II even, that war is always an admission of failure. When we have reached the point of armed conflict, we have failed. We have to realise, as I think we all do, that the wounds that will be inflicted by this conflict will exacerbate the wounds that already exist in the region, the mistrust that already exists. So when this war ends, and it will end as all wars end, there has to be a rebuilding of civic structures. There has to be a rebuilding of trust among peoples. We don't know how this is going to end. Regime change, is that a fanciful notion in itself? Sowing seeds of division in a society that's already quite diverse. I believe there are at least 12 ethnic groups in Iran. Pope Leo last Sunday, when he was visiting a parish in Rome, simply said that everybody is a peacemaker. Everybody has to keep the door open to reconciliation, to understanding the other, because the war will end and we will have to rebuild. And I say we because the international community who have been partakers of this war in different ways, reluctantly some, wholeheartedly others, will have to play their part in helping rebuild trust. And that's where international law and conversations and dialogue come in. So we have to remember, too, that war robs us of the future. I was listening the other day to a very eloquent reflection on this. The vast amounts of money which are being spent on armaments and war will not be recouped. That money could have been spent on education, on peace building, on peace enforcement. And so we have to recall that the peacemakers are the ones who pick up the pieces when the war is finished and the conflict has ended. But in the midst of that conflict, we have to keep open the possibility of peace. And peace is an active activity. It's not, you know, the absence of war. Peace is promoting dialogue. Peace is promoting getting to know the other. Peace is always seeking the good of the other. That is always the vocation of the Christian in any circumstance.
Do you know, one thing that I will say, though, I'm concerned, because when peace comes, you said it right at the very start, that depends on how people will live afterwards. And so for those that might have hoped for regime change, you now have obviously the Ayatollah's son who you know, will succeed as supreme leader.
If he's still alive today.
Exactly. And that shifts minute by minute, let alone hour by hour. So I totally take that. But the rhetoric changes. So it's to destroy Iran's nuclear capabilities in terms of weaponry. Regime change, well, if it all stops now, we saw 50,000 approximately people killed that took to the streets earlier in January. Yeah. I mean, what will happen? I fear for the people, Harry. What would your response be there?
This is why I said that my worry is as much for the ordinary human being, the man, woman and child in Iran, rather than just the military hardware and the fact that people living outside Iran, and also, I would add, outside the whole Gulf region, are sort of saying, yes, down with the regime, bomb them to existence. Yes, but these are people there who are feeling different from the people sitting in Europe or the United States or elsewhere. Before I come to that, what I would call a highly political statement that you made, and I'd like to elaborate on that, if I may, for 2 minutes, James, I would also like to comment on something that the bishop said. And again, in moments of distress, and I am distressed, I am in a bad situation. And I'm in a bad situation because it's not only what's happening to the Iranian people, it's not what's happening to the Saudis, the Bahrainis, the Qataris, the Kuwaitis, the Jordanians, all the people who are subject to Iraqis, but also because of the hundreds of thousands of people stranded all over the world, unable to go home because of what is happening there. The airspaces are shut. You have got airspace corridors and a trickle of people manage to go here and there. But let me, so for that distress, I use humor. And I talked to you about when I was a toddler during the 1967 war. Let me tell you another story. Many moons ago, when I was Assistant General Secretary of the Middle East Council of Churches, I was, every other month, I was in the United States for talks and meetings and stuff like that. And I remember that once I went there with the General Secretary himself, my boss, Gabriel Habib, who was a Greek Orthodox or an Antiochian Orthodox Christian from Lebanon. We both went there because we were going to speak at a big conference. And at that conference, I was given the honor of having the key address rather than General Secretary himself. And when I was talking, I sort of very proudly quoted Spinoza and said, war is not only the absence of peace. And then when we went for lunch, one of the delegates there who was there, he said, Harry, yes, but you did not continue the quotation from Spinoza. And that to me today is quite a good lesson because we are in an incomplete situation where we said, okay, let's start a war. But where is that war leading? I think there are two different directions for this war in Iran. President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu are not on the same wavelength when it comes to why they are waging this war. I personally think that Netanyahu pretty much convinced or coerced or forced Trump to join in a war against Iran because for the last 30 to 40 years, he himself has confessed, has avowed that his big dream is to get rid of the Iranian theocratic regime, the mullahs. Now, what I think would have happened if this were only an American adventure is that after the killing of the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, President Trump would have declared victory. He has a very good way of deciding and defining things. So he would have said, oh, we have damaged everything. Nothing remains there that is a threat to us. We've got rid of the supreme leader. That's it. We stop. That would have pleased his Arab GCC allies. It would have also spared the region from economic woes and physical destruction. So all this that we are hearing now about higher inflation, about stunted growth, about all the bills, this wouldn't have happened 3, 4, 5 days ago. But Netanyahu didn't want that. Netanyahu wants to destroy the regime. And when I say destroy the regime, I'm not saying replace the regime. I'm saying destroy it. If somebody else comes who can be on the same wavelength as Israel, then he would tolerate that outcome. But as far as Israel is concerned, and my deepest respect for all those peace-seeking Israelis, advocates who are working tirelessly against this war or to explain this war, Netanyahu and his cohorts, his ministers, would be quite happy to create a chaos in the region, because they created a chaos in Syria when Syria has now been basically disempowered, castrated militarily and to a large extent politically. Then we are now witnessing what is happening in Lebanon. We're witnessing what is happening in the West Bank of Palestine under the cover of this war. We're seeing what is happening in other parts of the Middle East as well. And I think that Netanyahu's big dream is to reconvert. I go back to Jeremy Bowen this morning, what I said at the start. He actually confirms my opinion that
What I see happening is that Netanyahu would be quite happy to have a whole region in a state of listlessness and chaos so that Israel becomes the hegemon, the only country that can control that whole region. So the Americans have Israel to take care of a whole vast of land, which we know as the MENA and Gulf regions. And then America could do what Obama wanted to do and he couldn't do, Biden wanted to do and he couldn't do, and now Trump's want to do, which is go to bed with China. That basically is the idea behind it. And no matter the cost, that is what Netanyahu wants. And interestingly enough, why didn't the Arab Gulf countries, starting with Saudi Arabia as the principal one, and then the small ones that follow, with the exception of the United Arab Emirates, which doesn't always follow, but they all have their own situation, and they all wanted the war not to start, because they were worried that what could happen is that they would end up with a mess which they would then have to deal with and suffer the consequences, because tomorrow Trump would say, well, that's it, I've got victory, off I go. And then reluctantly, after all the damage that Netanyahu has done in Iran and then again in Lebanon now, which is atrocious what's happening there. I'm not a fan of the mullahs, nor am I a fan of Hezbollah, but I'm not a fan of this kind of violence and war either. And then these Arab countries would have to deal with what is happening in the region. And that is what worries me. A billionaire Emirati person said 2 days ago on social media, and he's the first person to break that kind of reticence of the Gulf allies by not criticizing Israel and therefore America, or if you want to put it the other way, America and therefore Israel, he basically said, what do you want us to do? You're messing up the region and you want us to go into war against Iran so that you withdraw and then we're left with basically the mess that has been created. And this is why I think that the GCC 6, the six Arab GCC countries, Gulf Cooperation Council, are now seriously considering their options and thinking, did we do right with the Abraham Accords? Did we do right with putting all our eggs in the American basket? Or should we have basically looked at what China has to offer? Because interestingly enough, China and Russia, which could both be considered as allies of Iran, have not actually physically done anything to support Iran except verbally. And this is, I think, where we stand at the moment. And this is why I worry, because as one commentator wrote in a piece, can't remember where, because there's so much floating around the cyberspace, he said, we are witnessing Sykes-Picot 2026. And what does that mean? It means that Sykes-Picot, the first one, is the one that divided the world into different areas. France got these parts, the Brits got that part, Italy got one or two tiny pieces. And then Sykes-Picot 2026 is more frightening, because you've got one tiny state, Israel, with a megalomaniacal prime minister who is not worried to kill and maim so long as he gets his own way and preserves his own position. If we get there, the whole geopolitics of the region is going to change. And this is why countries outside the region should wake up instead of basically just trying to show that they are important. Or churches, because if Muslim leaders speak, they're going to be told, ah, you're Muslim, you're like the people in the Gulf. Of course you're going to say what you're going to say. But if we as Christians, and I include myself in that sort of tattered basket, if we are going to be true to our prophetic ministry, if, as the bishop said very rightly, that war is incompatible with justice, we have to speak out. And if we don't speak out because we're lily-livered, then we have to ask ourselves, what are we talking about? I again emphasize, and I'm sure the three of us would be in agreement on this, I'm not a fan of the mullocracy in Iran. I'm not a fan of what Hezbollah and Hamas have done and the mess that we are in today. But I also am not a fan when somebody unilaterally decides to go and pick presidents and kill them or kidnap them or whatever. I mean, it's incredible that you and I are sitting here and you talk to me about the successor of the killed supreme leader in Iran, his son, basically. And remember, the Islamic Revolution of 1979 came to put a stop to dynasty rule. And what do we see? We see the son. Why is the son, Mujtaba Khamenei, why is he there? He's there not because he would have been selected if there had been no war. He was selected because Iran is in that frame of mind, the devil with me and the whole region. It's basically lashing out everywhere to cause as much pain as it can, knowing full well that it is absolutely no match to the military hardware of the Americans and the Israelis. So when this guy I talked about, Khalaf Ahmad al-Habtour, the Emirati who talked, he's on social media, you can check it, I'm not creating facts. He sort of said, and what, are we to be left with the baby? This is what worries me. I was a toddler. I was crying when I heard the Hawker Hunters and the Mirages in the skies of Jordan and Palestine and Israel. Ditto with what is happening today. I'm not so worried because I'm old enough, and if I'm going to die, I might as well die. But I don't also go for this sense of martyrdom that everybody who dies, oh, he's a martyr, he goes straight to heaven. I cannot presume to know God's designs. So basically, we have to speak out. And if the West doesn't wake up, and if the West doesn't sort of stop being a poodle across the Atlantic, if we do not talk, in my opinion, we're failing our prophetic ministry.
Well, to be honest, Bishop Jim, you're frequently speaking out across the piece, but I'd like to go back in a sense to January. Because just 2 months ago, almost exactly 2 months ago, we were in Israel and Palestine. Mm. And Harry mentioned right at the top of the show that obviously there's great concern as to how this is spilling out across the region. Iran lashing out, as you say, the bombing of Tehran and the drones all over throughout the skies. But it is pretty quickly forgotten, isn't it, the situation in Israel and Palestine. How do you feel about that?
You're right. Once these conflicts dominate the airwaves and the news reports, they displace all the other. I mean, I have a particular concern for the situation in Palestine, the increasing occupation of the West Bank, or an annexation of the West Bank. The cost of living there is rising. Cost of living for people already barely surviving in Gaza. We have reports on the ground of what's going on and the continuing mistreatment of people and the encroachment on Palestinian sovereignty and the displacement of peoples. We're seeing an enormous displacement of people again in the region. Afghan refugees were being sheltered in Iran. Now again, those people are being displaced because of the fear of another war. The fog of war allows regimes and governments to, by stealth, if you like, attend to their misdeeds and local business without the scrutiny of the media and indeed the prophetic voice of the church and the prophetic voice of indeed all religions. So it is a cause for concern, and we hope that voices of concern and those who are concerned with human rights and their civil rights, you know, break through. I just want to pay a little compliment to Harry, if I may. Some 18 months ago, over a cup of coffee, you predicted or expressed a concern that the whole Middle East was being reshaped. And this was 18 months ago.
Yep.
you looked at what was happening and you said there is something going on underneath here, the tectonic plates. There's a reshaping of the region. And it looks as if, and your references to China, thank you for that insight about the Chinese dimension and the Russian dimension. This is a global moment and it calls for global solutions.
The bishop mentioned Afghan refugees. The number of Afghan refugees in Iran is higher than all the Afghan refugees across the whole of Europe. And they are in Iran. But in addition to the Afghan refugees, you also have, the bishop also talked about 12 ethnic communities. You've got the Azeris in the north of Iran. You've got the Balochistan people. If we are basically trying to sow division and discord so that all those rise up against the center, so that the center no longer can hold together, that in itself is a big, big problem. Because leading Iran into a situation of chaos is not only going to affect Iran, it's going to affect the whole region. And this is why the Arab countries, particularly the GCC allies, are so worried. James, if you look at a map, if our listeners look at a map, everybody's talking now. Yesterday on the telly, they were all talking, suddenly became experts about the Strait of Hormuz. Just imagine this narrow waterway. On one side is Iran, and on the other side is the United Arab Emirates and Oman. Imagine closing that waterway or mining that waterway, what it is going to do to the economies of those six GCC countries whose whole raison d'être is basically to say we're a safe haven for all those tourists and all those influencers. It's incredible. The United Arab Emirates is full of influencers, more than any other of the Arab GCC countries. And a lot of them are trying to find charter planes because they've got so much money, paying thousands of dollars just to run away. How are all these people going to come back? How is the Gulf region to regain its reputation as a place of holidays, of comfort, of money-making, of relaxation, if we keep on going in the direction that Netanyahu defines and Trump follows? So this is one thing. The other thing I would remind our listeners, because this is something I think that's key to what is happening in the region. We in the West have a different understanding of what war is. We look at war as how many things we destroyed, how many ballistic missile launchers we managed to demolish, how did we manage to close in the mountains those apertures which basically suddenly open and the ballistic missiles comes out or the drones come out. This is how they do it. This is how Hezbollah has done it subterranean. This is how Hamas had done it subterranean. This is how Iran has done it. Even its nuclear fissile program, is half of it is in the heart of those mountains. So the way we think about it, let's go and drop these bunker bombs and blow everything up to kingdom come. The Iranians, not only now, but have always known that they're no match for Western military sophistication. So what is their answer? The way they measure war is not by how much destruction we did, but time, patience, and resilience. How much time do we need to resist in order to deplete not only the interceptors that the West has and the Arab countries and Israel has, but also the patience of the West? Because if their people die, they consider them martyrs. If one soldier in the West dies, we have a big shock to absorb. And this is why I think we have to also see that there are different ways. And there again, I go back to Karl von Clausewitz, and he was in the 19th century. So this is what I wanted to highlight. It fills me with dread
And it fills me with a lot of dark thoughts for a whole variety of reasons. And when I look at the way Lebanon is now suffering, the government, President Aoun, Prime Minister Salam, Deputy Prime Minister Mitri, and all the ministers had agreed to disarm Hezbollah. Certainly south of the Litani River, which is a demarcation area that gives space for the Israeli communities across the border to be in peace and to live safely. Because Israeli communities went through their own trauma when in October 2023, the Hamas people attacked, and all those communities on the Israeli side of the Gaza border, what we call the Gaza envelope, they all were asked by Israel to go elsewhere because it wasn't safe anymore. And that was displacement. And by the way, I open a bracket, they should know what displacement is on the Arab side as well. So they went, they couldn't come back until 2 years later. And they've been saying, I listened to them in Hebrew, they've been saying that we had that once, we're not going to have it again. So now the Israeli thinking is, we're not going to let those Israeli communities on the northern border of Israel, the southern border of Lebanon, to have to be displaced again. So Israel is trying to demolish that area itself that the government of Lebanon could not yet disarm, because the government of Lebanon wants to avoid a civil war between an army that would fragment between Sunni, Christian, and Shia, and Druze if you want, and the south. This is what is happening. And what's the outcome? Let's not talk about the destruction. Let's not talk about the havoc. Let's not talk about what is happening in Lebanon, that poor little country that is constantly at the receiving end of every little hiccup in the region. 760,000 refugees at the moment. I don't call them refugees because they're IDPs. They're internally displaced persons. Where are they living? Hezbollah is not popular in Lebanon. There is a strong sentiment against what Hezbollah did by launching those missiles, because it invited Israel to do what Netanyahu had wanted to do, which is attack and try to destroy Hezbollah once and for all. And now, all the Shia people from the south of Lebanon, from the Dahiyeh neighborhood of Beirut, and from other parts of Beirut, are actually now homeless, and they are going and living with other people who do not always want to give them refuge anymore because of the tensions, intra-community tensions within Lebanon. Church leaders in the West Bank, every other day, they're making pleas. Look what's happening to us. Look what's happening to our communities. It is time for us to realize that it is a serious situation. I'm not asking people in this country to suddenly become all warriors, but I'm asking them to realize that there is something to think about.
No, absolutely. And look, we could probably take this special to 2 hours, I'm sure, let alone 1 hour. But we are hurtling towards our cutoff mark. So I think it's only appropriate, Bishop Jim, if we actually look at a more spiritual, prayerful context, certainly from your part, as we reach the end of this podcast. So I was going to ask, well, you know, how can our people respond to this tumultuous time and hold it in prayer? But what would you say? What is a response from our people or for our people?
Well, I think we have to listen carefully to those voices that break through the fog of war and remind us of the realities that are happening. We have to have a concern for the broken lives of all those involved. And we pray, and our prayer is in a sense a form of solidarity, a question for ourselves and a question to God, but it's also it's a form of protest. We raise our voice in protest. As the late Jonathan Rabbi Sacks once said, you know, these acts against humanity, not in my name. And Pope Leo, I think, is encouraging us to use our prayer to raise our voice against acts of inhumanity that to draw away from the dignity of every human person And perhaps we might end with a prayer shortly. I'm very conscious of all those, Harry's already mentioned it, family and friends who are stuck, in a sense, in the Gulf region, who cannot return home, whose flights have been cancelled, delayed, and are prevented. Some who might want to go back to Lebanon, some who have family in Iran and are isolated there. So I think we need to hold all those people and all those who are involved in the fighting in our prayer.
And so, Harry, before that prayer, would you like to just wrap with a very succinct final thought?
Yes. The only thing I would say is that the war should stop. Dialogue should take precedence yet again, which is what all level-headed people are asking for. And before the bishop concludes this special, let me just remind our listeners that we're breaking the hiatus because it is such an important moment. And I end, as we did offline, by basically saying Der Vogormia, Der Vogormia, translated Kyrie eleison, Kyrie eleison, translated Lord have mercy, Lord have mercy.
And I think to add to that appeal of mercy, quite rightly put, we have a prayer, Bishop Jim.
This prayer is based on that of Bishop Bosco MacDonald, the Bishop of Clifton. God of peace, Father of all, in this hour of fear and violence, draw near to all. Protect the innocent, shelter the displaced, comfort the grieving, heal the wounded, and strengthen all who bring relief and care. Turn the hearts of leaders from pride and anger. Give them wisdom, restraint, and courage, that the weapons may fall silent and honest negotiation may begin. Save the peoples of the Middle East from a widening war. Guard Christians and all religious minorities, and keep hatred from hardening into lasting division. Prince of Peace, Jesus Christ, make us peacemakers. Bless our Lenten prayers and sacrifices, and may they bear fruit in mercy, justice, and reconciliation. Amen.
Amen. Gentlemen, thank you very much.